Good evening. I think we're going to begin. Good evening. Welcome back to our third session in this series on Megillat Rut. Tonight we're going to be talking about chapter 3. I called it an immodest proposal, Ruth and Boaz at the threshing floor. Now, in the previous lecture, we noted that the tragic introduction of Megillat Rut leaves Naomi with two critical problems. One I called short-term survival, and we were talking about food, and the other I called long-term survival, and the problem, of course, involved progeny and continuity. Now, in our last class, we talked about the manner in which chapter 2 resolves the crisis of food. And chapter 3, I suggested, contends with the challenge of continuity, of Naomi's continuity and progeny for the family of Elimelech. So let's begin with chapter 3. Let's look in Rut, Perek Gimel, chapter 3, verse 1. And let's look at how Naomi immediately tries to resolve the problem of continuity of her family in the beginning of chapter 3. We open with the words, Vatomer la Naomi chamota, and her mother-in-law Naomi said to her, Biti, my daughter, halo avakesh lach manoach asher yitav lach. Will I not search for you, manoach, for some sort of resting place or repose, which will be good for you? Now, Naomi's bid to find a resting place or to find manoach for Rut is, at first blush, welcome. Right? It's a fitting reward for Rut's generosity in the previous chapter. And, of course, at this point, Naomi makes it clear that she has no qualms about helping Rut to enter the community, which was not something that we necessarily felt, not in the first chapter and not in the beginning of the second chapter. And this, of course, is a complete turnaround from the first chapter, where Naomi adamantly insists that Rut, along with her sister-in-law, Orpah, should not count on finding a husband in Beit Lechem, but rather should go back to Moab in order to find Minucha. It's the same word, right? She says to them, Yitain Hashem lachem umitzaena minucha isha beit isha. Both of the women should go back, and they should find a resting place, each woman in the house of a husband. Well, at this point, Naomi is hatching a plan to try to find Rut a manoach, a husband, in Beit Lechem. This is a complete turnaround from the first chapter, and of course, it suggests that Rut's activities in chapter 2 were rather successful, and that Naomi is actually grateful to Rut and also wants to welcome Rut into the community in Beit Lechem. And yet, although Naomi claims that this plan is for Rut's benefit, I would still ask, who is the real beneficiary of this plan, and whose concerns are paramount in Naomi's mind when she comes up with this plan, which she twice states is for Rut. Halo avakesh lach manoach asher yitav lach. I want to find you a repose that will be good for you. And yet, if you look, let's read a little bit of the continuation of what it is that Naomi is asking Rut to do. Let's start with pasuk bet, v'ata, and now she says, halo vaz modatanu. Is not Boaz our close associate? Asher hayit et narotav, and you were with his young girls. Hinei hu zore et goren haseorim halayla. He is winnowing the barley in the threshing house tonight. Virachatzt, and you should wash. Visacht, and you should anoint yourself. Visamt simlotaich alaich, and you shall put on your dress. Via radit hagoren, and you should go down to the threshing floor. Al tivadi laish, ad kaloto leechol vilishtot. Do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Vihi vishochvo, and it will be when he lies down. Via dat et hamakom asher yishkav sham, you should make known to yourself the place where he is lying there. Uvat, and you should come. Vigilit margalotav, and you should uncover his legs. Vishachavt, and you should lie down. Vuhu yagid lach et asher tasin. He will tell you that which you should do. Now, before we actually discuss this rather surreptitious plan that Naomi is sending Ruth on, and it's also rather suggestive. I want to note that Naomi's words here contain a technical peculiarity which could offer deeper insight into her intentions. I began by asking, what are Naomi's intentions? Who is the real beneficiary here? Who is she really thinking about when she's sending Ruth down to the fields in order to, I guess we should call a spade, to seduce Boaz, right? That's certainly what it seems like. And I want to note that there are multiple instances of kri uchtiv here, okay? Kri uchtiv is a Masoretic phenomenon in which a word is written one way and read another. And there are several kri uchtivs, many of you may have noticed this as we're reading, that seem to have a common underlying principle. And that is that while in the kri, in the part that is read, Naomi speaks to Ruth in the second person. She says, you should go down and you should put on your dress and you should make known where the man is. In the Ketiv, it seems that Naomi speaks in the first person, implying that she herself is going to the fields. Let's look, for example, in Pasuk Gimel, right? You see this kriuchtiv? I don't know how it's indicated. It's there, okay. So you see the word viaradit? So I read the kri, right? The kri is, and you shall go down. But if you look at the ketiv, it seems to say viaraditi, and I will go down. Look at the next pasuk, right? We have it again in the word vishachavt, and you shall lie down. But in the ketiv, it seems to say vishachavti. Now, we have a Gemara. I'm going to refer you to this first source on our source sheet. The Gemara, the Yerushalmi in Peah, actually relates to this Masoretic phenomenon. And as we often do, our tradition is that we try to interpret both, because both the Kri and the Ketiv are part of our tradition. It's part of the Masorah. And therefore, the Gemara suggests as follows. The Gemara says, Virachatzt, Visacht, Visamt, Viaradit Hagoren, Viaradit Tiktiv. But it says, I will go down. Amrala, Naomi said to Ruth, Zchuti tered imach. My merit will accompany you down. I will be with you. I will be with you in spirit, as it were. Now, this approach suggests, or it indicates, that when Naomi sends Ruth down to the threshing floor, Naomi is actually thinking about herself as well. She is acting on her own behalf. One could read this slightly differently than this Gemara, and perhaps with a bit of a negative slant. Naomi expects to live vicariously through Ruth. In fact, this is what happens in the Gemara, in the Megillah, right? At the end of the book of Ruth, when Ruth does actually have a child, she then does give that child to Naomi, right? In any case, I think that this is already indicated here in Naomi's initial plan. Everything that she's sending Ruth down to do, she's also thinking about herself being part of it. She's deeply engaged in the plan itself. Now, even if we say that based on Naomi's words, Naomi seems to have Ruth's best intentions at heart, and her best interest, she has Ruth's best interests in mind, Naomi's plan is confounding. And I would say especially for Ruth the Moabite. What Naomi asks Ruth to do is not simple. She is asking Ruth to behave in a bold, suggestive manner, to approach Boaz in the middle of the night. There is an abundance of sexual language that leaves very little doubt, and the Midrash is going to agree with this, that Ruth is being sent down to seduce Boaz. The word yada, to know, which often hints to sexual intimacy, is used twice in short succession here. Al tivadi la'ish ad kaloto viyadat et hamakom. Again, the context is not saying, it's not a sexual context, but it's suggestive. The language here is suggestive. The word shachav, to lie, which frequently connotes the sexual act, appears three times in verse 4, and it's going to appear three more times in verses 7 and 8, which actually have the story of what Ruth actually does. We have the word bow, which appears three times here, also in short succession. Look at the words, gilit margilotav. You shall uncover his feet. The word gala, to expose. This, of course, creates an association with the word ligalot erva, what we often refer to as giloy arayot, to expose one's nakedness. There's an abundance here of terms which suggests what it is that Naomi has in mind. And later on, if we actually look at what happens, look in Pasuk Vav, in verse 6. After Ruth actually goes down in deference to Naomi's plan, Vateret Hagoren, she goes down to the threshing floor, Vataz Kechol Asher Tzivata Chamota, and she did everything that her mother-in-law commanded her. Vayochal Boaz, and Boaz ate, Vayesht, Vayitav Libo, Vayavo Lishkav Bikze Ha'arema, and he came to lie at the edge of the pile, right? Presumably we're talking about a heap of grain. Of course, the word arema cannot fail to make us have the association with the word arom, which means nakedness, okay? And of course, the description in Pasuk Chet of the dramatic moment in which Boaz awakens in the middle of the night is likewise suggestive. Let's read Pasuk Chet. Vayhi b'chatzi halayla. It was in the middle of the night. Vayecharad ha'ish vayilafet. The man was frightened, and he grasped, Vihine Isha Shochevet Margalotav. There is a woman lying at his feet. Okay, this verse, we pointed this out in our last class, that this verse contains no personal names. It records the matter of a man who awakens to find a woman lying at his feet. The absence of names depletes the individual's of their identity. They are merely genders. What we are witnessing here is what I think is a highly charged moment, which is deliberately alluded to by the text, in which a man and a woman, two people of opposite genders, meet in an isolated field in the middle of the night, right? So, I mean, I think that the scene itself is preparing us for what inevitably is meant to take place, and also suggests to us what Naomi intended should take place. This is undoubtedly the most peculiar and morally questionable scenario in the Megillah. Naomi's plan is bewildering, and it must have been bewildering for Ruth as well. Now, it's important also to recall, this is a very, I think, significant point, that Ruth is a Moabite whose reputation is on the line here. And I want to suggest, I know that many of us are very familiar with the Midrashim, which often portray Ruth as the paradigm of modesty, right? The question in the Gemara and Shabbos, and Daf Kuf Yud Gimel on page 133, 13, where the Gemara asks, why does Boaz notice Ruth? And the answer is because she's picking so modestly in the fields. And of course, that image has been preserved in art throughout the centuries, where Ruth is often depicted and painted by artists in this, pose, this very modest bending down to pick, to glean, to harvest in the fields. And yet, if you pay careful attention to the text itself, what you see is that Ruth has come a long way since Perek Bet, right? When she first arrives in Beit Lechem, she comes from a Moabite culture, and she is oblivious to the norms of modesty that are taking place in Beit Lechem. I think if we engage in a short exercise in reading chapter 2 carefully, we can better illustrate this point. So let's look for a moment in chapter 2, verse 3. And let's see what happens when Ruth arrives at the field. The first thing she does, Vatelech Vatavo Vatilaket, she goes and she comes and she gleans, Basadeh Acharei HaKotzrim. Right, so she goes and she harvests after the reapers. And this doesn't tell us very much because the word Kotzrim, the plural form, can easily indicate a group of men and women, right? There's no indication that she's specifically with the women from the word kotsrim. Look again in Pasuk Zion, right? When the foreman cites Root's words, and I suggested in our last class that this is a derogatory portrayal of Root. He is citing her in a deliberately derogatory manner. Look at what he says. Vatomer, I'm going to use the tone that suggests derogatory. Vatomer, and she said, Alakata nav asaftiv omarim achare hakotsrim. She said, I am going to pick those bundles after the reapers. Again, it's gender neutral, the word kotsrim. It could be men and women. But look at when Boaz instructs Ruth in the next pasuk. Look at what he says in pasuk chet. Vayomer Boaz el Ruth, halo shamat biti. Have you not heard my daughter? Al tilchi lilkot besadeh acher. V'gam lo ta'avori mizeh. Don't go to another field. Don't pass by here. V'cho tidbakin im na'arotai. Cleave to my young women. And look at the next pasuk where Boaz keeps using the distinctive female case to emphasize this. Look in pasuk tet. Einayich basadeh asher yiktzorun v'halacht achareihen. Right? You should go after them, the female women, and you should pick with them, the female women. Now, it appears that Ruth does not understand the hint. And there are two indications of this. One is in Pasuk Yudalid, okay, skipping ahead, same chapter, verse 14, when Ruth comes to eat after Boaz invites her to eat in the field, we're told as follows. I'm going to go right straight to the middle of the Pasuk. Vateshev mitzad hakotsrim. Once again, that plural. She sits next to the reapers. If you're still not convinced that Ruth has actually misunderstood something here, look ahead in Pasuk Kaf Aleph, okay, verse 21. And here what we see is that this wasn't just a lazy plural form that was indicating men and women, but it seems to be that Ruth actually misunderstood that there seems to be gender separation going on in Boaz's field, because look at what Ruth says. Vatomer Ruth HaMoaviah. Okay, note that she speaks as a Moabite. Gam ki amar Eli, he also said to me, im hane'arim asher li tidbakin, I should cleave to the boys. That's not what he said to her at all. He said very specifically, cho tidbakin im na'arotai. He said, cleave to my girls. She misquotes him. She misquotes him here. And if you're still not convinced, look at what Naomi says to Ruth. Look at Naomi's reply to Ruth. She sort of gently but firmly corrects what I would call Ruth's indiscretion in Pasuk Kavbet. Vatomer Naomi el Ruth. Naomi says to Ruth, Kalata, her daughter-in-law, Tov biti ki tetzi im na'arotav. Okay? It would be good, my daughter, if you would go out with his daughters, his young women, right? You should cleave to the young women. And now she finally gets it, okay? Because look at the next pasuk. Look at the last pasuk of chapter 2, verse 23. Vatidbak bina'arot boaz lilaket ad klot k'tzir haseorim uktzir hachitim. It took a while, but Ruth eventually internalized what it was that Boaz and Naomi seemed to be saying to her. And therefore, what I would suggest is that despite the well-known portrayal of Ruth in several midrashim, and Rashi brings some of these midrashim as well, as an innately modest woman whose modesty is evident to all who see her from the moment that she arrives at Boaz's field, we're going to see that there's another midrash which points to a more natural learning process and the likelihood that Ruth is struggling to understand and to internalize the practices and the norms in the society in Beit Lechem. So look for a moment at this next midrash that I brought for you in source number 3. This midrash seems to be well aware of this textual reading that we just did in Perek Bet, and says on the words, Vatomer Ruta Moavia, Gam ki amare la ima na'arim asher li tidbakin, when she misquotes Boaz here, Amar Rav Chanin Bar Levi, Bivadai Moavia hi zo. She is most certainly a Moavite. Hu amar v'chot tidbakin im na'arotai. He told her, you should cleave to my young women. V'hi amra, im hanarim asher li, v'tidbak v'narot Boaz. And the end, of course, is that she learns that she should cleave to the young women. And so by the end of the chapter, Ruth seems to have internalized the customs in Beit Lechem. But this, I think, even more so makes us understand the precarious nature of Naomi's request. Ruth's situation is precarious. Her reputation is on the line. She has struggled deeply to try to learn the ways of Beit Lechem. And what we see here is that when Ruth responds to Naomi's plan, she is decidedly unenthusiastic. Look at what she says in Pasuk Hey. She is under no illusions that this is not to her benefit. In Pasuk Hey, in Perek Gimel, Vatomer Eleha, Ruth responds to Naomi, Kol Asher Tomri Elai Eseh. Everything you tell me, I will do. Not, this is a great idea, I'm thrilled to do it, happy to help out. This is definitely, she's definitely responding positively to Naomi, and everything that Naomi tells her she will indeed do, but it does not seem that she perceives it as something which is to her benefit. And this, of course, only strengthens our question with regard to Naomi's plan. Imagine really the havoc that would ensue if someone in Beit Lechem, which is, of course, a small, tight community, would find out what Ruth is doing. Imagine if somebody had looked out of the window and saw Ruth on her way down to the fields as dusk was falling, all bedecked and bejeweled and with her makeup and her perfume. That's one scenario which would certainly suggest that it would create problems for Ruth. What if, alternatively, Boaz were to react negatively? What if we were to wake up and see this woman lying at his feet and he were to become outraged at her suggestive and bold appearance at his feet in the middle of the night and perhaps make a public issue of it, right? We're taking a very big risk here. Why does Naomi tell Ruth to do this? Is there not a better way? Perhaps that's the best question. Why doesn't Naomi just knock on Boaz's door, right? That seems to be perhaps a simpler route. Now, I guess it would seem obvious that the answer to this is that Naomi is convinced that there isn't a better, a more direct route to obtain her goals. And this seems to be indicated also in chapter 2, because while Boaz does assume responsibility for providing Ruth with food, and he does so with great willingness and I think with great finesse and nobility, he also seems to relegate ultimate responsibility for Naomi's, for Ruth's protection, including what seems to be an allusion to her marriage and her continued fertility. He assigns responsibility to God. Okay, look for a moment in Perek Bet, Pasuk Yud Bet. After Boaz praises Ruth's actions, he says to her, Yishalem Adonai Poalech, Utihi Maskurtech Shleima, Me'im Adonai Elohe Yisrael, Asher Bat Lachasot Tachat Knafav. God shall repay you, and your reward shall be full from God, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. Now, note, and I brought it for you here in source number 4, that when Ruth actually puts the onus on Boaz, when she meets him in the field in chapter 3, she uses very similar words that he used to shift the burden to God, right? Naomi comes in Perek Gimel, Pasuk Tet, right? And she says, Vatomer Anochi Rut Amatecha, Ufarasta Knafecha Al Amatcha Ki Goel Ata, right? Because you need to spread your wings over your maidservant, for you are the Redeemer. Don't shift the responsibility to God. And so this might be, I think, part of what Naomi is sensing, is that Boaz has no intentions of doing anything for Ruth beyond providing her with food. And of course, one, I think, very good evidence that this is in fact the case is that the harvest season ends and Boaz makes no further overtures towards Root. He's also, of course, made no move to help Naomi, right? It doesn't seem that he contacts Naomi at any point in the story. In fact, I mentioned last time that Boaz and Naomi never meet in the story. There seems to be some sort of chasm that is between them, which is also evidenced, I think, by Naomi's actions, which illustrate that she regards Boaz as unapproachable, right? She does not think that she can simply knock on his door and ask if he is ready and willing to assume responsibility as the Goel or as a potential redeemer to marry Ruth. And still, even having said that Naomi feels that there isn't a better direct route, I still think her plan requires an explanation. Why does she send Ruth to act in this rather illicit and suggestive manner? I want to start by noting that Naomi's plan seems to be based on solid biblical precedents, right? There are several noteworthy incidents in which we have desperate women who contrive to ensure continuity for their family by acting in an unexpected, in a bold, and even in a forward and suggestive manner, right? In fact, I would say that this portrayal is consistent with the way in which women are often portrayed in Tanakh. Women are often portrayed in Tanakh as willing to act courageously and innovatively in order to ensure continuity. Perhaps the best example of this, or a cluster of examples of this, appears at the beginning of Sefer Shemot of the book of Exodus, right? The story of the Exodus from Egypt, right? It depicts, the male members of society who seem to have largely given up on continuity, a point which finds expression in many different midrashim, right? The famous midrash that tells us that Amram divorced his wife and then all of the men followed suit and they also divorced their wives. And by the same token, we have this very, very concentrated depiction of women who are willing to risk everything to ensure continuity, to bring about life. We have the midwives who risk their lives to protect the Hebrew children despite a direct order from the most powerful man that the world knows, and that is, of course, Paro. In the next story, we have three women who, one after the other, defy Paro's orders in order to save the newborn Moshe, right? We have Moshe's mother who engineers an elaborate plan to hide him. We have Moshe's sister who guards him. And then, of course, in an extraordinary twist, we have the daughter of Paro himself who adopts him, right? And the Midrashim love this portrayal. The Midrashim supply numerous extra biblical stories that seem to be designed to underscore the extraordinary behavior of the Jewish women in Egypt, primarily in their attempt to ensure continuity. But those aren't really the incidents I think are most directly related to what it is that Naomi does. I think some of you already know where I'm going with this. I think that there are two previous biblical incidents which involve the bold initiative of women that particularly exist in the background of the story of Boaz and Ruth. The first story that I'm talking about is Lot's daughters, right? In Genesis chapter 19, when Lot's daughters get him drunk and then they sleep with him. And then, of course, we have the story of Tamar and Yehudah, right? In both stories, and that, of course, appears in Genesis chapter 38, in both stories, women who are desperate for progeny, who are in terrible fear that there will be no more continuity, employ deception, or perhaps more specifically, the lack of knowledge of the man in order to deceive a man into sleeping with them. Okay, in the case of Lot's daughters, they get their father drunk. In the case of Tamar, she disguises herself, she conceals her face under a veil and portrays herself as a prostitute, as a harlot, in order to seduce her father-in-law. Now, it's intriguing that Naomi actually seems to conflate these two stories when she sort of gently pushes Ruth towards a deception. Okay, first she tells Ruth to dress up, right? Like Tamar. And then she tells Ruth to wait until Boaz finishes le'echol v'lishtot, eating and drinking, perhaps a little bit reminiscent of the story of Lot. In fact, there is good reason to read into the story that Lot is somewhat inebriated, right? Vayitav libo, we're told, and his heart becomes merry, which sometimes in the Tanakh seems to suggest a certain state of inebriation. Certainly, it seems that he doesn't recognize Ruth, right? Vayilafet v'hinei isha shochevet margalotav vayomer la mi'at, who are you, right? He doesn't seem to recognize her. And of course, the most extraordinary link between these three stories is the genealogical link, right? That's the proverbial feather in the cap of comparing these three stories, which suggests that there is a deliberate link between these three stories, because the story of Lot and his daughters produces Ruth, and the story of Tamar and Yehudah produces Boaz. And so the three stories come together in this sort of triangle. These stories and the rather bold, if not brazen, actions which defines the action of the women in each of these stories seem to be connected genealogically. Now, it's important to note two things. One is that Chazal are very aware of this. There are many different midrashim that compare these stories. Not only that, but the Megillah itself is aware, certainly, of the connection between Tamar and Yehudah and Ruth and Boaz. Because at the very end of the story, when Boaz is given a blessing by the people, the blessing is, Vihi veitcha kveit peretz asher yalda Tamar li Yehudah. Right, so the very mention of the story of Tamar and Yehudah in this story actually seems to create a deliberate allusion to at least that other story. Now, what I want to try to do now, and perhaps we'll open for a moment to the chart that I brought for you here, I guess on page 3. What I want to do now is look at this chart. I want to engage a little bit in make a little bit of a methodological comment now. I want to do a little bit of an intertextual analysis. It is very common in the Tanakh. We're often comparing different stories. And what I want to suggest about Megillat Ruth is that many, many, many different stories seem to be echoed in Megillat Ruth. These stories reappear in the scenario in chapter 3 in Megillat Ruth. What I'm going to suggest is that the story of Yehudah and Tamar and the story of Lot and his daughters undergoes some sort of distillation process or purification process, which refines and corrects the previous narrative in Megillat Ruth. That's what I want to see here. But let's look at this chart that I brought for you. Each of these stories begins with a separation between brothers. That's how the story begins. The story of Lot starts when Lot leaves Avraham. That is the first move that is moving towards the seduction of his daughters, right? Because the seduction of his daughters doesn't just appear in the middle of the text without any background. The background starts when Lot leaves Avraham. The story of Yehudah and Tamar starts when Yehudah leaves his brothers. Vayered Yehudah me'et echav. Yehudah leaves his brothers. And that's, of course, right there stuck in the middle of the story of the sale of Joseph, right? Yehudah leaves his brothers. And our story begins when Elimelech leaves his brothers. Now, each of these protagonists, in their very act of leaving, engage in what I think is an inherently repugnant act. Not just because they're leaving their brothers, but because of where they go. And if you think about it, they each pretty much go to the same place, okay? Lot goes to Sodom and Amorah, okay? Yehudah goes to Canaan. Okay, he marries a woman from Canaan. That is a movement away from Avraham. Just as Lot's movement to the culture of Sodom and Amorah turns his back on the ways of Avraham, Yehudah's movement is a movement away from Avraham. And of course, Elimelech goes to Moab, Moab being the spiritual heir of Sodom and Amorah. The culture of each of these destinations of these men who leave their brothers is depicted in all three instances as the antithesis of Avraham's culture, of Avraham's value system, of Avraham's character. Avraham, of course, is the paradigm of chesed. Avraham is the paradigm of generosity. He is also the paradigm of separateness from an immoral sexual culture. He is the one who says to his son, you may not marry the women of Canaan. Of course, what do we know about the women of Canaan? Kimaseh, not just the women of Canaan, but the people of Canaan. Kimaseh eretz Canaan lo tasu. Do not do any of the things that the people of Canaan did. And that's, of course, linked in chapter 18 and in chapter 20 in Leviticus to sexual immorality. These cultures are depicted as societies which encourage cruelty and sexual immorality. And so what I want to suggest is that each of these stories begin by abandoning Avraham and his values, by entering, by immersing themselves in an anti-Avraham-like environment. Now, this is what happens to Lot. Lot, of course, goes to Sodom, and then we have the story of the people surrounding his house, demanding that he relinquish his male guests so that they can rape them. And of course, Lot says, oh, no, no, but here, take my daughters instead. It's a terrible story. And that's the story that is the result of Lot leaving behind the culture of Avraham. I'm not suggesting necessarily that Lot is the evil one, but Lot has chosen to go to a culture which is, in fact, evil. Now, one of the things that I want to suggest here, and I think you'll understand where I'm going with this, is that Avraham is the one who gets the blessing of Zerah and the blessing of Adama, right? Avraham is the one who gets the blessing of progeny and the blessing of land. These are the two problems in Megillat Rut, okay? Now, one of the things that we see with Yehudah is that when Yehudah leaves his brothers, he leaves the family of Avraham, and he goes to Canaan, and he marries a Canaanite woman. What we see, first of all, is that he's not going to dispossess the Canaanites of their land, right? He's not going to get their land because he's marrying into them. And more importantly, what we see with Yehudah is a distinct lack of concern for progeny, right? He doesn't rebuke Er for spilling his seed, and he doesn't give Shelah, right, his third son, to Tamar as a wife. It seems, and perhaps this is on the backdrop of the sale of Joseph, that Yehudah has consciously abandoned his share in the destiny of the family of Avraham, which is about land and about progeny. He seems distinctly unconcerned, both with getting rid of the Canaanites, with the land, and with progeny. And of course, this is what happens to Elimelech as well. When Elimelech goes to Moab, he goes to a place which is the antithesis of Avraham. And of course, by deciding to abandon Avraham's vision, what really happens, of course, is that he loses Avraham's promise. He loses the blessing of the land. He loses the blessing of progeny. And that is the situation that we have in Megillat Rut. Avraham represents continuity, permanence, and land. And what happens to these people is, as they leave Avraham and they become immersed in an anti-Avraham-like culture, they are each threatened with erasure, with the destruction of their family line. Look at this second line that I wrote here, right? After Lot goes to Sodom, we have the destruction of the cities of Sodom and Amorah. And of course, Lot is threatened with being part of that destruction. After Yehudah leaves his brothers and seems to turn his back on the promise and the values of Avraham, his sons die, and of course he refuses to allow his third son to marry Tamar, and it seems that he has no future either. And of course, this is the story that we have here in Megillat Rut. And this, of course, leads to a crisis. And so in each of these stories, the women take action. Okay, when the threat of destruction hovers over the family, the women take action and they engage in deception. Okay, each of these women, we'll talk for a moment about our first two stories, deceive a man who is unlikely to sleep with them, perhaps for good reason, right? I mean, it's the father and the father-in-law. And they do this in order to perpetuate the family line. Now, what's interesting is that Chazal, the Midrashim, consider them to be worthy of praise for these actions, right? Largely, there's a little bit of controversy regarding the daughters of Lot, but Tamar gets a tremendous amount of praise for accolades are heaped on Tamar for what she's done. I'll just show you, for example, this Gemara in source number 8, this Gemara in Nazir, which tells us as follows: "My dichtiv ki yesharim darchei Hashem v'tzadikim yalchuvam ufoshim yikashelubam." What is meant by the verse, "For the ways of the Lord are right, and the just do walk in them, but transgressors stumble therein"? Ella, what is this? Mashal lilot ushtevnotav imo. Now, if you read the story, what you see in the story is that the girls plan to get their father drunk. They get him drunk and they sleep with him, one after the other. It would seem pretty self-evident from reading the story that the one who is innocent is Lot, and that those who are actually engaged in the deception are the daughters of Lot. But look at what the Gemara says. Mashal Lot u'shtevno tavimo, hein shenit kavnu l'shem mitzvah. The ones who were, their intentions were to do a positive deed, v'tzadikim yachuvo. Who should need kaven l'shem avera ufoshim yikashlubam v'dilma who nami l'shum mitzvah kaven, right? And the benot Lot, the Gemara seems to suggest, are the ones who deserve praise. They are the ones whose intentions were to do a positive act. But maybe he also did v'ha minis anis. He was forced. It wasn't really his fault. The Gemara is going to go on and say, it's not exactly true. We'll see that in a few minutes, that he was forced, but he actually knew about it, even though the pasuk tells us v'lo yada. So here we have this description, almost this comparison between Lot and his daughters, in which Lot is the bad guy, and his daughters deserve praise because their intention was to do a positive act. The same thing is true about Tamar. Okay, both Tamar and the daughters of Lot deserve praise or receive praise from the Midrashim and from the Gemara because their intentions were to continue the family in a desperate situation. And so, if we return for a moment to our original question, which is, what was Naomi trying to do? What was she thinking in this plot of hers that sent Ruth down to the fields to seduce Boaz? And if we think about, in fact, of course, the mechanism that she uses to obtain continuity, it's not that surprising anymore. Maybe it's even an expected and accepted mode of action for a virtuous biblical woman whose line is threatened with extinction. Perhaps, this isn't going to be my final answer, don't worry, but perhaps in the final analysis, what we're learning from the text is that when the family line is threatened, the women will resist in any way that they can, and they will engage in unconventional and even morally questionable behaviors in order to obtain continuity. And think about this. This is part of the legacy of the Davidic dynasty. This is the family tree of the Davidic dynasty. Ultimately, the bringing of the Messiah, the bringing of Mashiach, is rooted in the courage and determination to resist annihilation and to obtain continuity. I think that itself is, in fact, a powerful message. And yet, it seems to me that the key to understanding this narrative in Megillat Rut is not merely to note the comparison between the stories, but also to be sensitive to the differences between them, and especially what actually transpires in our story. I think we already know that our story goes in a very surprising and different direction than the earlier stories. And let's start with the fact that in both of these early stories, the sexual act is a forbidden incestuous act. Okay, so it's before the Torah was given. But we are still talking about Lot and his daughters and Tamar and Yehuda. But not here, right? Boaz is permitted to Rut. But more significantly, in both of the earlier stories, think about this. The man who is deceived into sleeping with the woman is the man who is responsible for the situation.
He's the man who's responsible for the annihilation of his family, or the near annihilation of his family. We're talking about Lot and Yehuda, the very men who left the fold and chose a different path. They're the ones who the women deceive in order to bring about continuity. There's a very strong message here. The women are not just saying, I'm going to get continuity at all costs. They're also saying, you were wrong to turn your back on the bracha of Abraham. You were wrong to risk the annihilation of our family and to go to this culture. Now, in our story, it's different. Right, because Elimelech, of course, is the man who opens our story by abandoning his brothers and by going to Moab and by turning his back on the path of Avram. But it's Boaz who Naomi chooses as the candidate for deception. And this can explain, of course, the third and most important difference between our story and the earlier stories. And that is, of course, with regard to the deception itself. Does it work? Does it work? Now, in the case of Lot and his daughters, the answer is a resounding yes, right? That seems to be at least what the text tells us. Let's look for a moment back in source number 5. This source here in Genesis 19, I alluded to it before. I mentioned it several times, but let's look in the fourth line here in Pasuk Lamed Gimel in verse 33, where it says, "Vatishkena et avihen yain balailahu." They give their father wine that night. Vatava bichira, and the elder one comes. Vatishkav et aviha v'lo yada bishochva uvekuma. He did not know when he lay down and when he got up. Now look at the look at two verses later. Verse 35, Lamed Hey. We're in source number 5, for those of you who are still looking for where we are. Lamed Hey, Vatishkena gam balaila hu et avihen yain. They also, again, gave their father wine on another night. Vatako matzira, and the younger daughter got up. Vatishka vimo, and she slept with him. Vilo yada b'shichva uvkuma. And he did not know. Look at those words. Vilo yada b'shichva uvkuma. Now, we have a similar phrase with Yehuda, okay? Let's look in source number 6. Here we have, look in Pasuk Tedvav. Pasuk Tedvav, we're told, Vayir'eha Yehuda, Yehuda sees her. Really, let's start in Pasuk Yudalit. Okay, Vatasar Bigdei Al Minuta Me'aleha. She takes off her clothes of being a widow. Vatichas Batseif Vatitala Vateshav Petach Einayim Asher Al Derech Timnata Ki Ra'ata Ki Gadal Sheila V'hi Lo Nitna Lo Leisha. She disguises herself and she stands on the road because she realizes that Yehuda is not going to give her the third son to marry. Vayir'eha Yehuda. Look at what happens. Yehuda sees her. Vayichshiveh L'zona. He thinks she is a harlot. Ki chista paneha. I'm gonna translate this not like Rashi, right? Because her face was covered. Vayet ela ko'el haderech. And he turned to her on the road. Vayomer, and he said, Hava na voileich. Let me come to you. Look at the next words. Ki lo yada ki chalatohi. He did not know. In both of these stories, we have a similar, almost an exact phrase. Lo yada. Lot didn't know. And Yehuda didn't know. I want to talk for a few minutes about what it means not to know. What it means to be deceived, okay? I would suggest that lack of knowledge in Tanakh is often presented as a moral failing, right? No one obtains knowledge easily. Knowledge is something which is acquired by choice. Knowledge is something which is acquired by effort. Knowledge is something which is acquired because one cares about acquiring knowledge. And the best biblical example of this, I think, is Mordechai. Right, Mordechai in Megillat Esther, he is always described as the one who knows. Vayivada hadavar leMordechai, uMordechai yada et asher naasa. Right now, while some midrashim actually want to view Mordechai as a particularly intelligent and knowledgeable person, it seems to me that Mordechai is own words to Esther may help to explain to us why he's constantly described as the one who possesses knowledge. When Mordecai attempts to persuade Esther that she must go to the king and plead on behalf of her people, what does he say to her? He says, "Im hacharesh tacharishi ba'et hazot, revach v'hatzala ya'amod la'yudim imakom acher." If you're silent at this time, the Jews will be saved by another source. But then he goes on and he says, you remember the next words? Umi yodea im la'et kazot. He got la malchut. Who knows? Maybe it's for this very reason that you were chosen to be queen. Now, think of Mordechai's statement. He doesn't say, I know that it is for this reason that you've chosen to be queen. Of course, Mordechai cannot know for certain why Esther was chosen. Nobody knows anything for certain. And yet, the human inability to reach certainty in understanding the world does not absolve them of the obligation to seek knowledge. That's who Mordechai is. Mordechai is the one who turns to Esther and says, who knows? I don't know and you don't know, but you at least have to explore the possibility that this is the reason that you were chosen to be queen. It is only the one who seeks knowledge, one such as Mordechai, who can ever possess knowledge. And therefore, what I want to suggest is that the Tanakh's description of the lack of knowledge of Lot and the lack of knowledge of Yehuda suggests that they have chosen not to know, that they have opted out of knowing. In fact, they've shirked responsibility for their destiny. And part of shirking responsibility for their destiny is their depiction as they did not know, right? In fact, I think both Lot and Yehuda's apathy is very evident from the beginning of the story and throughout the story. The Ramban's going to comment on Yehuda's apathy. The Gemara is going to be very critical of Lot's lack of knowledge, which we'll see in a moment. But I think this is all part of their opting out of their being part of the destiny of Avraham. They choose not to know. In fact, this Midrash that I quoted before in source number 8, the Midrash in Masechet Nazir, expresses skepticism about Lot's ostensible lack of knowledge, right? What does the Midrash here say? Look at this last part of the first paragraph that I brought for you here, the last two lines. Lama nakud al vav, right? We have this dot over the vav of bishikva uvkuma, right? The Gemara goes on and says, Lomar shebishikva lo yada, aval bikuma yada. Right. When he went to sleep, he may not have known, but when he got up, he surely knew. Now, in a sense, this Midrash is wreaking havoc with the text. That's not what the text says, right? Seems likely that the Midrash is skeptical about Lot's lack of knowledge, perhaps because of the doubling of the episode, right? It arouses suspicion. How could it happen twice that Lot was so fully deceived by his daughters? However, I would venture the possibility that the Midrash is also commenting on why Lot is so easily deceived and Lot's personal responsibility for having allowed himself to be deceived, which is because of his apathy. It is not so simple to deceive someone who doesn't wish to be deceived. Now, Yehuda's ignorance of the situation would also seem to be a product of his lack of desire to know, which of course is manifested in his apathetic attitude toward his destiny, perhaps because of the sale of Yosef, as I mentioned, Yehuda's decision to go to a harlot on the road, and his willingness to give her his identifying symbols of kingship, right? According to the Ramban, he gives her his symbols of kingship. He gives her his chotam, his ptil, his mate, right? His staff and his seal. These are, of course, symbols of kingship. This, and along with his failure to know who she is, to recognize his daughter-in-law, they are all born from the same general decision that Lot has made, that Yehuda has made, sorry, to turn his back on his destiny. In fact, what I want to suggest is that Lot and Yehuda both abandon their destiny. They are unconscious partners in their own deception, and this is part and parcel of their initial decision to leave Avraham and go to an anti-Avraham culture, which eventually puts them on the path to erasure, to destruction. This isn't the case with regard to Boaz, right? It simply is not the case. Boaz never abandoned his destiny in the first place. He never left Beit Lechem. He never went to Moab. He never gave any indication of apathy with regard to his own destiny. And Boaz, of course, does not want to be deceived. He cares about his destiny, and therefore, he is not easily deceived, and he will not be deceived in this story. Now, if we look at Naomi's instructions, back if you look at the beginning of Parak Gimel, you'll see again how similar this story is to previous stories and how profoundly Naomi is aware of these previous stories and seems to be modeling her plot on the previous stories. Look at how she twice uses the word yada in the negative. Right, she says in Pasuk Gimel, right, you should go down, you should dress yourself up. I'm in Parak Gimel, Pasuk Gimel, at the end, of, in the, right in the middle of the Pasuk, Al tivadi la'ish ad kaloto le'echol velishtot. Don't make yourself known to the man. It's a deception, right, until he is satiated and perhaps even inebriated, right? The text portrays Naomi's intentions to deceive. Al-Ivada, she actually says something else. She also informs Rut that Rut should retain the knowledge, right? Look in Pasuk Dalet, she says, Vihi v'shochvo v'yadat et ha-makom asher yishkav sham. You should know where he is, but don't make yourself known to him. She seems to be almost consciously, perhaps even consciously, reenacting the previous episodes of deception. Now, with everything that I've said until now, and I think even if you just read the text, even just a sort of a cursory reading of the text, there seems to be little doubt what the eventual outcome of this scenario is going to be. Boaz is going to awaken to Ruth's seduction, and inevitably he's going to succumb, like Lot did, like Yehuda did. That's what's suggested here throughout the beginning of this chapter. Even the Midrash perceives this as the obvious outcome. Let's look here at this last Midrash I brought for you in source number 9. This is the Midrash in which Rabbi Yehuda says, Kol oto halayla, that entire night, haya yitzro mikatrigo ve'omer. His desire was prosecuting him and saying, Ata panoy umevakesh isha. You are single and looking for a woman. V'hi pnuya umevakeshet ish. And she is single and she is looking for a man. Amod uvoala, get up and have relations with her. V'tiel chalisha, and then she will be your wife. Okay, this is the expectation also of the Midrash. Contrary to our expectations, contrary to the natural flow of the text, both linguistically and especially in light of the previous episodes, Boaz does not permit himself to be deceived. And so once again, we arrive at that same critical watershed moment that I pointed to in the last class as the turning point of the Megillah, when Boaz turns to Rut and says, look in Parak Gimel, Pasuk Tet, Vayomer, Mi'at, who are you? Right? There's no chance that he will not know, because Boaz cares about knowing. Right? In the previous class, we examined the significance of this moment in the context of Boaz's concern for the other, right? His regard for Ruth as a subject, his ability to provide people with a name and identity. Right there, we noted that if in chapter 2, Ruth is stripped of her personal identity and reduced to a Moabite, in chapter 3, she's stripped of her personal identity and reduced to a gender. She is a receptacle for a child. She's just an isha. And it is Boaz that gives her back her identity in both of these dangers. He turns her from a Moabite into Rut. He turns her from an isha into Rut in both of these cases. This is the climax of the narrative. This is the stunning turnaround of the Megillah. And yet, I think we have to understand it in a broader context as well. The moment in which Boaz asks Rut who she is a turning point in the history of these biblical scenarios. There is little doubt that women assume the responsibility of continuing the line when all hope has been lost, especially when in the society others have lost hope, right? When there is no more hope for Ge'ulah, when people like the Goel are walking around refusing to bring about Ge'ulah. And this may be the reason that one of the name etymologies that Chazal offer, that the Midrashim offer for Machlon and Chilion, is Shenityashu min ha-Ge'ulah. They lost hope in redemption, okay? Of course, in our story, it's not just Naomi who retains hope in the future and in maintaining and in obtaining Ge'ulah, but Boaz as well. The ideal scenario is not when all hope has been lost, and therefore a woman has to come and restore hope. The ideal scenario is not when the Tanakh relies on the woman to take action. The ideal scenario is when the man has not opted out, but chooses to take part in the fulfillment of his destiny, to fight alongside Ruth for continuity, to recognize the meaning of Ruth's bold actions, and become an enthusiastic participant. And that's, of course, what happens. This narrative cleans up this potentially difficult scenario. Boaz functions differently. He refuses to be deceived. He single-handedly adjusts this scenario to reflect a mutual battle for survival, a mutual struggle for continuity. The woman no longer has to deceive the man, and the scenario can proceed in a pure and public and valid official manner. And that's, of course, what happens in Perek Dalet. I want to show two things that Boaz does here that shows us how he reverses this scenario, actually rather consciously. One is the fact that Boaz keeps using the word yada, okay? Boaz wants knowledge, right? What does he say to Rut in Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yud Aleph, right? He says, Vatabiti al tiri, don't be afraid, my daughter. Kol asher tomri eselach, I'll do everything that you ask. Ki yodea kol shar ami ki eshet chayel at. Everybody knows, right? He is alluding to public knowledge. He is concerned about knowledge. And Boaz actually also uses, interestingly enough, the negative phrase al yivada, actually in order to bring about a deception of his own. It's quite interesting. He actually uses the same nif'al form of the verb used by Naomi. If you remember, Naomi said at the beginning to Ruth, al yivada, right? Al yivada, al tivadi la'ish, ad kaloto lecho vilishto. Do not make yourself known to the man until he finishes eating and drinking. Look what Boaz says, actually, towards the end of Perek Gimel. In Perek Gimel, pasuk yudalid, right after after the long night, Vatishkav Margalotav ad haboker, she sleeps at his feet until the morning. Vatakom b'terem yakir ishet re'ehu, she gets up before a man could recognize her, his friend. Vayomer, and he said to her, al yivada kiva ha'isha hagoren, do not let it be known that a woman has come to the threshing house, right? So Boaz himself does engage in a deception of sorts, but of course this deception is to safeguard Ruth's pious reputation, which Naomi had risked, right? It's almost the opposite of what Naomi does. Naomi tries to engage in a deception in order to bring about the scenario, a repeat of the previous scenarios, to deceive Boaz into sleeping with Ruth so that continuity can be brought about. And Boaz, who will not accept his own lack of knowledge, is in fact staunchly determined to withhold knowledge from anyone who would misinterpret Ruth's conduct. And the second thing that Boaz does is he takes this secret, rather surreptitious, seductive scene, and he turns it into something which is public and transparent and official and appropriate. And that's Perek Dalet. Right? Perek Dalet, everything is done out in the open. He makes transparent all of everything that seemed to be sort of shrouded in darkness and in seduction and in lack of identity in Perek Gimel. Boaz brings it to the fore in Perek Dalet, and he gathers everybody together. And actually, look at the words that he uses in Pasuk Dalet. He turns to the people who are sitting at the gate. There is no more public place than the gate. And he says, Vani Amarti, Egle Oznecha Lemor. Look at that word, Egle, right? It reminds us a little of that Giloy right here. He says, but here he's saying, I will uncover your ear. In other words, I will reveal to all of you, I will inform everybody of my honorable intentions. It's the opposite of the Giloy Margalotav, of the uncovering of the feet that Naomi had asked Ruth to do. And so the narrative of Boaz and Ruth harnesses the power of the woman's drive for continuity to create an enduring and stable dynasty. And yet at the same time, it filters and purifies the story so that instead of featuring an apathetic protagonist who has turned his back on his destiny and has relinquished his hope for the future, it features Boaz, an honorable and idealistic figure who believes in Geula, who believes in continuity, who believes in the future, and decides to work together with Ruth to bring about continuity and kingship. And so to a certain degree, what I'm trying to say here is that Boaz, almost single-handedly, corrects the previous scenarios of Lot and his daughters and Yehuda and Tamar, which lingers in the background of this narrative. And yet, I want to end with one final point. It's not only Boaz who fixes the problem of Lot. The problem of Lot is somehow the background of our story. And the reason it's the background of our story is because it is also the background of the book of Judges. In our first lecture, I talked about the way in which the book of Judges plays with, or Megillat Ruth plays off of the book of Judges in order to correct the almost hopeless situation of the nation of Israel during the time of the Judges. It's not just Boaz that corrects the story of Lot. Ruth fixes the story of Lot herself in a very significant way, which has deep ramifications for fixing the situation of the nation during the period of the Judges. Recall that Lot begins the story by making a bad decision. His bad decision involves two things. First of all, I think it involves separating himself from Avraham. Think of the words, Vayiparadu ish me'al achiv. Right? And each man separated from the other. But secondly, of course, he decides to live in close proximity to Sodom. Vayehal ad Sodom. He makes his tents close to Sodom. And Sodom, of course, is a place which is described as a place where Anashim, people are ra'im v'chata'im lahashem me'od. They are very evil to God. He chooses to live in a culture which is diametrically opposed to the values of Avraham. Now, I'm not suggesting that Lot is a bad guy. In fact, there's some debate about this question among the Mefarshim. Radak really likes Lot. Rashi a little less. Right? The Radak really likes Lot, and he has good reason for liking Lot, because Lot seems to be pretty much similar to Avraham. He also wants to take in guests. He also wants to protect his guests. He doesn't seem particularly enthused about the possibility of allowing these evil townspeople to do evil to the men who have come into his house. And yet, even if Lot himself wants to hold on to Avram's values, I think what begins to happen in the story is that the ramifications of Lot's choice begin to become more and more evident. In fact, he just finds himself in a tight spot. But his tight spot that he finds himself in is a direct result of his bad decision. He's in a situation which he has placed himself in. He himself is not a bad person necessarily, but he finds himself in a bad situation, which is a result of his bad decision. And the ultimate result of Lot's decision is very clear. What emerges from Lot is Moab and Ammon. What he leaves behind in this world, his legacy, are the spiritual heirs of Sodom and Amorah, two nations that are not generous, that don't take in guests, that don't give food and water, That's the opposite of Avraham. That's the opposite of what Lot wanted to be. This is the end of Lot. The product of Lot is Sodom and Gomorrah, is basically Moab and Ammon, which is Sodom and Gomorrah. And so Lot pays for his choice to live in close proximity to evil and to cultures which are the opposite of Avraham. This story of Lot, I believe, is what happens in the book of Judges. In the book of Judges, the period of the Judges begins when Am Yisrael make the same choice as Lot. They choose not to finish the conquest of the land. They leave the Canaanites in the land. They are too lazy to finish the conquest. They do not heed the advice of the Torah, which indicates quite clearly how disastrous it will be if they live in close proximity to the moral debauchery of the Canaanites and their idolatry and their sexual immorality. And as a result, what we see throughout the book of Judges is the nation sliding slowly but surely off of the path of Avraham onto the path of Lot. And this, of course, leads us to the end of the book, in which the story of the concubine, we talked about this in the first shiur, is a recreation of the story of Lot. In fact, Am Yisrael finds themselves right smack in the middle of Sodom and Gomorrah because they made the Lot choice. Am Yisrael has created an anti-Avraham society during the period of the Judges. How do they get back to the path of Avraham? Well, on the one hand, we mention Boaz comes to correct the story of Lot. And yet, Rut is the primary figure who does this. Rut stands at the crossroad between Moab and Beit Lechem, between the culture of Sodom and the culture of Avraham. And she makes a choice. Her choice is unequivocal. It is the tikkun. It is the correction of Lot's choice. She abandons Moab. She chooses the path of chesed. She chooses the path of generosity and of giving. She returns to the path of Avraham. She closes the circle of Lot. And if you think about some of the ways in which she is described, for example, in her great oath of loyalty to Naomi, listen to her words. She says, "Ko ya'aseh Hashem li v'cho yosif, ki hamavet yafrid b'ni u'b'nech." You hear the word? It's the same word that was used to describe Lot and Avram's initial separation. Vayiparadu ish me'al echav. And here Ruth says to Naomi, "Only death will separate me from you." It is the historic closing of the circle of Lot's choice to leave Avraham. And of course, this is the reason why Boaz in Perek Bet, Pasuk Yud Aleph, turns to Rut and says to her, "Hu ged hu godly kol asher asit et chamotech. It has surely been told to me everything that you did for your mother-in-law. Ba'asher ozvi avich v'imech ve'eretz moladetech. You left your father and your mother and your birthplace, and you went to a nation which you did not know." I hear echoes of Lech lecha me'artzecha u'mimoladecha u'mibeit avicha. Rut makes the Avram's choice. Lot's descendant Rut returns to the path of Avraham. She becomes a paradigm of chesed and, of course, remains as a legacy also of the paradigm of modesty. In doing so, she doesn't just do this for herself. She acquires the tools and the authority to serve as a role model who is capable of guiding the people during the period of the Judges from the errant path of Lot back to the path of Avraham. Rut is not just a personal role model for this movement. She accomplishes much more than that. She also, along with Boaz, the two who correct Lot, produces the Davidic dynasty, which becomes the vehicle for the nation's return to the path of Avraham. Megillat Rut produces a dynasty of kings which leads the nation away from Lot, back to Avraham, back to the chesed, which is really, I think, represented by Rut, and the sexual morality, which is reinstated by Boaz, to restore this, not just for themselves, but for the Jewish nation at the time of the Judges. Thank you very much.